This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Gibbon. It was second semester of his sophomore year at Penn State, and Zeke Cook was in trouble. He was home from school, not by choice.
I decided that it would probably be in my best interest to try to, you know, add exercise to my life. So I started running, and I was reading Born to Run for some form of inspiration.
Born to Run is Christopher McDougall's 2009 best-selling book that fueled the barefoot running craze. And Chris McDougall just so happens to be Zeke's neighbor and old family friend. Zeke's mom, Andrea, left a message explaining that Zeke was spending a semester away from school. And would Chris be willing to take him for a run?
And you have to understand what the Cook family's like. They don't rattle. So to get a phone call and hear that Zeke is home from college, suddenly like alarm bells are going off. Like, this does not happen to the Cook family.
Chris is a big believer in movement as medicine. So he figured whatever trouble Zeke was in, running would probably help. But before talking to Zeke, he needed to get Andrea on the phone for some intel.
So I pick up the phone, call. I thought I was calling her cell phone number, and I actually got the home number.
Zeke answered the phone.
I was like, hey, man, I was interested in going for a run. I'm home from school. And Chris kind of said, yeah, we should do a run tomorrow. Are you available tomorrow? And he's like, yeah. And then he's like, I'll tell you tomorrow.
So you invite him for a run, but you don't tell him that there's going to be a donkey involved?
Would you tell him? No way.
The donkey's name is Sherman. What advice did you give him when you handed him Sherman's lead?
Stay out of the line of fire, buddy. No, I think I downplayed it. I said, let's just go out and have some fun. Watch those back hooves. That's their defense mechanism, is to kick. And let's just see what happens.
Chris still didn't know what was going on with Zeke. But the run that day wasn't only about taking care of Zeke. It was also about taking care of Sherman. Sherman came to live with Chris and his family in the fall of 2015.
It was fully my daughter Sophie's fault. She was 9 years old, and I made the crucial mistake of asking her what she wanted for her birthday. And the answer was a donkey.
The McDougals live in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, Amish country. And at just that moment, another neighbor was trying to rescue a donkey from a hoarder.
We first saw him locked in his stall in the darkness, so we knew he was in bad shape. But we didn't realize how bad it was until the next day when our neighbor was able to pry this donkey away from the hoarder, bring it to our home, and we saw it in daylight for the first time.
The donkey's hooves were so overgrown and deformed, he couldn't walk.
And if donkeys can't walk, they can't survive. They need to move in order to digest their food and pass it through their digestive tract.
Chris called Tanya, a local vet assistant, and her husband Scott, an amateur farrier. That's someone who takes care of an animal's hooves.
And I'm in a state of panic. Like, I have my daughter's 10th birthday gift, which is about to die an excruciating death in front of her eyes. Can you help? And their answer is, don't worry about it. Donkeys are tough. We've seen it all. No problem. They come over the next day. They take a look at this donkey and they go, we've never seen this before.
Scott used a hacksaw to cut through the donkey's hooves and then clipped and filed them into shape. When it was all over, the donkey should have walked away, but he didn't.
He was standing there, glassy-eyed, immobile, shell-shocked. And Scott's looking at him saying, you know, it may be too late. If he doesn't move, he's going to die. It might be better to put him down right now.
But Scott's wife, Tanya, wasn't ready to give up.
Tanya blazed in. She was just like a white ball of avenging thunder. She was so furious at what this hoarder had done.
Tanya injected the donkey. By this point, Chris's daughter had named him Sherman with antibiotics and painkillers and started shearing off the fur that had become matted with filth. As she worked, she was already looking beyond the current problem to the next one.
She just kind of turned to me with those kind of clippers in my face and said, now look, you're not just going to drop him out of field. He's feeling despair. He's been abandoned. You got to give him a job. He's got to have a reason to open his eyes and look forward to something. The only thing I could think of is, like, I'm not like a prospector. Like, what? I don't have a job for a donkey. But 10 years earlier, I had been to Colorado to cover a story for the World Championship Pack Burro Race.
Yep. The World Championship Pack Burro Race. It's held every July in Fairplay, Colorado. Participants run alongside donkeys up and over a mountain. The short course is 15 miles.
I'm scanning desperately. Job, job, job. Oh, hey, pack burrow race.
Chris was sure Tanya would think this was a terrible idea.
She kind of looked at me. She's like, okay, all right, I see this, but it's going to be step one is, can this creature even put a foot on a hard surface?
By the next morning, Sherman had made a friend, a goat named Lawrence. Wherever Lawrence went, Sherman followed. He was finally moving. But there was still the question of whether Sherman would willingly step on a hard surface. Donkeys are naturally distrustful, and Sherman had never seen anything outside the hoarder's small, dark stall. So when Tanya tried to lead Sherman out to the road, he stopped just short of the asphalt. Tanya spent the next 40 minutes locked in a battle of wills until Sherman finally set one hoof on the road.
She turns to me and she goes, see that? That's the power of a second chance. And I'm like, you're right. We're giving him a second chance. And she's like, I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about you. Why do you think he would ever trust a human again? Humans have made his life nothing but miserable. He's giving you a second chance, buddy, and you better live up to it.
Chris and Tanya had less than a year to get Sherman in shape for the World Championship Pack Burrow race, but they soon realized that he wouldn't go anywhere without a friend. So Tanya brought over her big riding donkey, Flower. Tanya would ride Flower. Chris would follow behind, running with Sherman. Flower was fast, but she was afraid of everything. Cows, puddles, the color yellow.
So we had to triple down and bring in a third donkey. And then my poor wife, Mika, who was not down with any of this plan, suddenly gets recruited to be the third donkey runner.
By this time, it was Thanksgiving, and Tanya was facing trouble at home. She could no longer join Chris and Mika for their daily runs. And without a third handler, the donkey trio was stalled. So when Zeke Cook's mom called to see if Chris would be willing to take her son for a run, Chris thought he might have found a solution to his problem, but he still didn't know why Zeke was home, and he knew handling Sherman wouldn't be easy.
We're early in the process where, you know, if we could go a quarter mile, that was huge. And it's a quarter mile of, like, him twisting and turning, and it's this endless, like, mind game. That's what I was throwing this poor kid into.
So when did you finally learn what Zeke was up against?
It was Zeke who told me. And,
Chris pushes back from the microphone and looks away. And for the next 30 seconds, he doesn't say anything.
Longest pause in radio history. All right.
Yeah, I don't like thinking about it.
Yeah.
So he's the one who told me, and he was very matter-of-fact about it.
Zeke is still matter-of-fact about it.
I had actually been kind of going through a seriously depressive episode in my life where I had essentially attempted to commit suicide.
Zeke had been hospitalized. He was allowed to return home under the condition that he attend regular therapy sessions and work with doctors to find the right mix of medications. When Zeke's mom asked Chris for help, she hadn't breathed easy in weeks.
Depression, man. I hate that word because it's such a misconception of what this thing is. It's not being depressed. It is being stricken by a life-threatening illness. And if it can hit that kid, man, you know, this kid's got everything going for him. So if it's attacking his brain, it can get anybody.
Zeke wanted to get back to his friends and to his studies at Penn State, but he knew he wouldn't be able to until he was no longer a danger to himself.
It became pretty apparent to me that simply taking a few antidepressants and not making wholesale lifestyle changes, that would not be enough for me to be healthy at school. And so for me, it was more about kind of trying to rebalance some of my wiring. So exercise was the first step for me. And then beyond that, it was nutrition and then, I guess, donkeys.
Because, as it turns out, by handing Zeke Sherman's lead that day, Chris had tapped into something ancient and often overlooked, the connection between humans and animals.
I mean, there's a reason why, like, right now you pet a cat and it purrs and you feel really good. It's not because it's cute. It's because, ancestrally, if you had a wild feline and that creature with far better auditory sense and night vision and sense of smell realized that there's no danger in the perimeter, that gives you an indication like you can relax now. You bring a dog into a cancer ward, and the requirement for pain medication cuts in half. Anxiety, stress levels drop in half.
Chris didn't plan to partner Zeke, the fastest runner and least experienced donkey handler, with the slowest and hardest to handle donkey. But he says Zeke and Sherman chose each other right from that first run.
We stopped it for a quarter mile, assessing how's everyone doing, and Sherman's just leaning his head against Zeke's leg. They were just brothers at that moment.
Zeke, the kid fighting depression, and Sherman, the donkey with abandonment issues, soon started to realize that they could help each other heal.
I think that with depression, it's a malaise that kind of makes it very difficult for you to look beyond the immediate problems. It's almost like you're in a perpetual state of panic. You feel kind of afraid all the time. You feel trapped, I guess. And so when you're dealing with an animal that has needs that they can't articulate, it gets you outside of your own brain.
Soon, Zeke was showing up every day to get outside of his own brain with Sherman.
I remember one morning he was like cold and wet and like, oh, you know what? Let's just call us bag it today. And we look up and there's Zeke pulling the drive like a half an hour early. Dude, what are you doing here? He's like, well, I realized early on that you'd be relying on me for consistency and punctuality. And I think, you know, that was it, man. He felt that his job was to be like the kind of team captain here. And he was getting the exercise, the animal contact, and the sense of need. Like, we needed him.
It was kind of the rock around which I kind of rebuilt my life.
And as Zeke started to feel better, so did Sherman.
I just had such a vivid memory of seeing Sherman, ears in the air, mane flopping back and forth, whole body just sort of jiggling along. Different animal entirely from the animal we brought. The animal we brought was dead-eyed, glassy-eyed, slumped over, head down, and suddenly like frisking along like a little like show pony in a parade. And Zeke always in contact, like his hip like brushing against Sherman's side.
4 years after coming to live with the McDougals, Sherman is happy and healthy. He still lives at the McDougals farm, but now his running buddies Flower and Matilda live there too. Zeke visits Sherman whenever he's home.
He, I would say, is more sociable. He's much, I'd say, more inherently trusting of people. I think I maybe gave Sherman some sense of peace.
And what did Sherman do for you?
I'd say Sherman is a big part of the reason why I was actually able to go back to school and graduate. You know, when I got back to school, it was like, I trained with a donkey. I can do this. I can do anything.
Zeke Cook is currently taking a gap year between undergrad and grad school. Christopher McDougall's new book, Running with Sherman, chronicles the three-runner, three-donkey team's attempt at the 2016 World Championship Packboro Race. But that's a story for another day. Not long ago, Bethany Erickson was out of sorts. A friend recommended she try rowing.
I'd never rowed. It sounded intimidating. But the website suggested that rowing could change lives. Sign me up, I said.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
News breaks and big stories change every day. That's why we're giving you NPR's 10-minute morning news podcast on Saturdays, too. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up first, start your day with us weekdays at 6 Eastern and Saturdays at 8, a bit later to suit your weekend from NPR News.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
Jackson stops on the dime, slides past Van Noy, and is out of bounds.
Second-year Baltimore Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson stole the show during last Sunday's victory over the Patriots, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and by Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks so much, Karen.
Thanks, Karen. Good to be here.
All right, Ken, take it away.
Well, your first mention is really what I've been focused on this week, this whole Lamar Jackson, Tom Brady moment. And bigger than that, where are we in terms of the black quarterback? Many people have pointed out this is the 50th anniversary of James Shaq Harris being drafted into the National Football League in 1969, and he became the first prominent black quarterback in the National Football League. And, you know, what does that mean? Where are we now? And if you think about when Lamar Jackson was drafted, some of the same conversations that were taking place back then were taking place with him, a dual-threat quarterback. You know, not so much the race issue as it was back then, but all the coded language there. Mm-hmm. So to see Jackson beat the GOAT, Tom Brady, kind of brought it all to a head and gave us another moment to reflect on what it means, but also the conversation that's still taking place about athleticism versus thinking quarterback or just a great quarterback without all the qualifiers that come into play. If James Shaq Harris was kind of 1.0 and we had a period of time where it was 2.0, where there just weren't that many. Mm-hmm. Now, this season, we have the largest number of black quarterbacks that we've had since 2013, and we're tied for that number. Are we in kind of a 3.0 moment? And how do we get to 4.0 where we don't have the conversation at all? Or we can have the Jackson versus Brady, you know, duel, and it is just these two great quarterbacks, and look at these two different styles, and not take it much further than that.
Rachel?
Well, I don't think we're quite beyond this issue yet, unfortunately. And I think that's because there's a larger issue in the NFL with a lack of representation among all levels of leadership. Mm. I think only two head coaches in the NFL this year are African-American, which is continually shocking. I often think in the context of this conversation about Warren Moon, who, of course, was not drafted, but ends up in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And this is not ancient history. He played in the year 2000. I think that we still are in a place where, you know, progress is not linear. It's not always just up and up and up and better. And I hope, Ken, to your point, that this is a 2.0 or 3.0 in terms of black quarterbacks, and that we'll continue to see progress because they're not totally representative of the makeup of the league, and they should be.
So before the 2018 draft, Bill Polian, he's a Hall of Fame GM, suggested that Lamar Jackson would be better off as a wide receiver. And right. Polian just didn't think Jackson had the size to be quarterback because he's 6'3", 211. And everyone knows the ideal quarterback is at least 6'4", 220. I mean, come on. That's crazy. And one of the really cool things that happened this week is that Polian came out and said, I was wrong. And I always think of this, the NFL really obsesses over these little differences in height, in weight. And I think sometimes those distinctions are just an excuse for the distinctions that nobody wants to say out loud. And I think it's great that this is changing. Lamar Jackson has 637 yards rushing through the first 8 games of this season. Tom Brady has rushed for just over 1,000 yards in his entire career. This is his 20th season. But I was reading Lonnie O'Neill's piece in The Undefeated, and she quotes a historian who says of black quarterbacks, they are the next generation of civil rights workers because in some ways they're risking their bodies to change a country. And I think about all the damage done by rushing, and that quote just really punches me in the stomach.
I read that quote as well, and I think about that kind of analogy, you know, in the same pantheon as, you know, Bill Roden with his $40 million slaves kind of analogy. Mm-hmm. It just strikes me as a little bit too far to take it. You know, Rachel said something that's very important in terms of how these things change. And what we can't forget is Ozzie Newsome, an African-American man, one of the few African-American general managers, was in the draft room when Lamar Jackson was drafted. So it is, just like corporate America, just like the rest of the world, the more inclusive and diverse these rooms are, the easier it will be to make decisions based on merit without any reference or any lingering thoughts of whatever someone's personal bias may be.
That sounds like a good thing. So on Monday, The Athletic dropped a report suggesting that the LA Chargers, formerly of San Diego, were considering a move to London. To be fair, the report only said that the Chargers, quote, would at least listen if the NFL approached them about London. Now, since the report dropped, Chargers owner Dean Spanos has fired back with the following rebuttal. It's total, this is our home, and this is where we are planning to be for a long time, period. he might be just protesting a bit too much there. Despite the protestations, and the NFL has denied the report too, I think the Chargers in London sounds like a pretty good idea. I mean, this two teams in LA thing is a failed experiment, and London has got to be better than selling 90% of your tickets to fans for the away team. Ken, am I right on this one?
Well, you're right about the idea of how we're going to make a league global.
Mm.
There's a famous story that one of the leagues that were playing overseas early on, that the fans were kind of watching, you know, mundanely as touchdowns were being scored. And then somebody kicked a field goal and they went crazy. Because they were the idea of, you know, I think it was Barcelona, the idea of seeing a great kick. But I think we're beyond that. And I think the success that the various leagues have had in London does bode well for that as a possibility. I still, you know, as we've looked at this over the years, it's still a problem of travel. Mm-hmm. And it's maybe if you get a team that's also in Paris, you know, maybe that's when it happens. But in terms of revenues, can we put the Chargers back in San Diego?
I'm all for it. Rachel?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, this is not a Chargers problem. This is an LA football problem. Mm. You know, the Rams have had problems, too, with attendance. It's tough in big urban areas, somewhat ironically, in California to draw to football games. And this is a longstanding problem. I mean, ask USC and UCLA. Los Angelinos, they are basically like, you know, show me the record before they're willing to show up and watch games in person.
I have a lot of family in Southern California. And it's also there are just generations of football fans in Southern California who are not fans of a team. They're fans of particular players. Hmm. They don't have the same affiliation when it comes to the teams. All right, Rachel, it's your turn.
Okay, well, last week, New Jersey Advanced Media reported on some troubling tactics by the softball coaches at Rutgers. In one instance from the story, after Rutgers players went $6 over their food travel budget on a road trip, they were told to run 6 100-yard sprints each in less than 17 seconds. Some players were left crying, doubled over in exhaustion. One player said she blacked out. This week, the Drake Group, a longtime critic of college sports, called for something interesting. They called for a prohibition of physical punishment of athletes. And they weren't talking about physical abuse, but using exercise as punishment. And the group actually drew a dotted line between the amped up workouts in the heat that preceded the death last year of a Maryland football player and post-practice sprints that coaches use as a penance pretty routinely. You know, experts say that using exercise as punishment at best teaches, you know, younger people to hate exercise and at worst puts them in physical danger. So I think a lot of us probably haven't even questioned this practice. But what do you two think of this? Is this something we should really consider, banning exercise as punishment?
Well, the show often allows me to bring up my sordid sports history. But I am a pre-water break athlete of the 70s. I'd never reflected on it in that way. I tend to try to stay in shape, but I do have a little attitude about exercise. And I wonder how much that really is something to be concerned about. You know, the idea of running wind sprints or doing something that gives you a moment to reflect is meaningful. But certainly in the examples of players dying and that sort of thing, that's an extreme.
I know there are people at home who are like, hey, my high school coach made me run wind sprints. And if it was good enough for me, it's good enough for those kids today. But, you know, like when I was in high school, I rode around in the back of a pickup truck. It didn't kill me, but I'm not going to say it was a good idea, right? Like we've learned. That said, this came up this week because of that report about the Rutgers softball team, right? Mm-hmm. And if the report is to be believed, and I'm not at all questioning it, the women on this team were being flat out abused by their coaches. And the fact that those coaches used exercise as punishment seems to me to just be a symptom of that abuse. So isn't it possible to use exercise as punishment for good and not for evil?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I think in the modern sort of age of sports where teams have nutritionists and they're measuring vitamin D levels and they have these very precisely prescribed workouts so you don't, you know, run too much or lift too little, you know, it strikes me as just counterproductive to have a planned practice and then just tack on all these sprints. You know, I mean, that is going to affect an athlete's recovery, maybe his or her sleep, all these other things.
Yeah, when you think about it, back in my day when the coach gave Wentz sprints, it might have been part of the plan the whole time.
Maybe. They were just waiting for you to mess up, right?
Right. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman and Professor Kenneth Shropshire, CEO of the Global Sport Institute at Arizona State University. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
Bethany Erickson is a rower, but she wasn't always. Here's Bethany.
When I turned 50, a friend invited me to an indoor rowing studio in Brookline, Massachusetts. I figured she thought of me as the avid outdoorsy mountain climber I used to be and had not noticed that beyond her social media view, I'd totally fallen out of shape and then out of sorts. In retrospect, my friend is a therapist and may have known exactly what she was doing. I'd never rowed. It sounded intimidating. Getting up sounded intimidating lately, but the website suggested that rowing could change lives. Sign me up, I said.
Excellent, excellent.
I was slow, but I didn't know it yet, and I thrived in the tough love environment. Take as long as you need to rest, my trainer likes to yell. You have 10 seconds.
Drop that split down by another 5 seconds.
The studio is cozy, with wood beams, Women's March posters, and chalkboard notices for challenges that support local charities. Okay, turn it up now. This is a full power workout. My trainer is the owner, a muscled giant with an infectious smile named Brian Fuller. He believes in giving back. He served in the Army and then got an MBA in a series of unsatisfying financial jobs. He felt dangerously low. One day, he tried a rowing machine at the gym, and it clicked for him. Soon after, he saw a sign for a community rowing program for veterans. Joining a team of vets on the Charles River, he finally discovered the support and validation he'd been lacking. Now he aims to share not only his love of rowing, but also that important sense of community.
All right, guys, we're down to our last 3 minutes. These are our favorite 3 minutes.
Brian pushes everyone with military volume and drive, but then quietly hands someone who's coughing a lozenge, loans another a book for their kid, or tells a goofy joke when someone's struggling. He watches his clients' rowing form carefully, stays with new members as they learn, and looks out for everyone's health in general. Don't forget it's the farmer's market today. Mm-mm, tomato season. With proper form, indoor rowing uses about 86% of your muscles. A couple months in, I could feel about 84% of them most of the day. And other issues stored in my body began working themselves out. One day I froze when a man came into the studio looking exactly like my late hiking partner. I had whispered, "See you down the trail," as he lay dying years ago. But knowing Brian was a veteran helped give me the courage to face my ghosts and move forward. And the exercise was helping me sleep better. I tried to come in no matter what I felt like. I told myself I could suck if I needed to. I just had to show up. Brian, I reminded myself, was the same age. Around the same time I became notorious in the rowing studio for actually rowing right out of my sneakers, I learned that Brian was notorious for more than being a tough but kind trainer. A year after he started rowing in that veterans program, he became one of the few Americans to have rowed across the Atlantic. And he's planning to do it again. I started lacing on my sneakers more carefully. "It's not as hard as you think," he said offhandedly about that row. But I'm not fooled. I am a better dork than athlete, so I immediately read 5 books by people who had rowed oceans, and a couple about being lost at sea for good measure. One woman had survived being pitch-poled, that's flipping bow over stern, in her boat in a hurricane. I asked him more about his experience at sea. He admitted it was hard at first, but that connecting with others kept him afloat thanks to a satellite phone. Once he got into the groove of it, he'd spent his time in the seat composing a children's story in his head about an animal finding her purpose. And when he returned, he opened a rowing studio. He told me I actually had the right personality for a row across the ocean. I found it harder to find excuses not to come in after that. 2 hours of sleep? Well, it wasn't like I was rowing the whole ocean, after all. But now I also had this glimmer that if I wanted to cross the Atlantic, I could.
Punch it out.
Something about the atmosphere of Brian's studio speaks to his knowledge of life being short and sometimes stormy, and of now being the right time for connection, imagination, and action. So I keep showing up, no matter what's happening in my life or body. No more treading water. Perhaps rowing really can change lives.
That's Bethany Erickson. She's a writer and artist from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Brian Fuller is planning another Atlantic crossing nearly a decade after his first. In 2017, Columbus Crew fans rallied to save the crew.
We brought together an international community of concerned soccer fans.
I would say that we were the most successful grassroots movement in the history of American sports.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the kid reporter who hopes to soon be in locker rooms everywhere. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
So the LA Clippers sat Kawhi Leonard twice in the first 8 games of the season. First, the internet lost its mind. Then the NBA said, it's okay, he's injured. Then coach Doc Rivers told reporters Leonard was feeling great. Then the league fined the Clips. Have I got this about right?
Well, yeah, except you left out the most important thing, which is the fact that we have a new entry in NBA jargon, which is load management situation.
Ooh.
Which sounds like something that ought to involve, like, dump trucks and gravel. Yeah, I mean, the NBA back-to-backs are tough. So they have a load management situation with him. It's just that nobody knows how to talk about it publicly yet. Because
right.
It's not supposed right. to happen.
Right.
I mean, it's sort of like the bastard stepchild of tanking. But basically what you're doing is you're trying to make your team better in the long run
yeah.
by resting your valuable players. But you're charging, I don't even want to guess how much per ticket, and you got to have a convincing lie. And no one has one yet.
I mean, it is only the third week of the season.
Yeah.
Do we have many more months of this kind of drama?
I think so. I mean, it's until they find a solution for this. And I couldn't begin to tell you what one might be. I mean, spontaneously cutting ticket prices because you know the visiting star isn't going to play doesn't sound feasible to me. It's certainly going to be a point of influence for the league. They're going to look around for examples of this now.
Yeah. Can we talk about the Chicago Bears?
No!
They've lost 4 in a row.
Sports!
They're currently 12th in the NFC. In last week's game against the Eagles, they had just 9 net yards in the first half. 9? What is going on with the Bears?
They really stink, Karen. They're a bad football team. They built their team. They built up a defense. The defense is still really good, by the way. But their offense is the petrified forest. The Mitchell Trubisky experience has not gone well for them. I suspect we'll talk about him in television in
will.
A moment. But they're just not that good on offense. And eventually, teams built that way, I mean, unless they're the Baltimore Ravens of a few years ago, teams that are built that way break down. And those Ravens, by the way, had a running game. The Bears don't have one of those either.
Well, as you say, the team is so bad that quarterback Mitchell Trubisky wants all the televisions inside Halas Hall. That's the Bears' headquarters and training facility turned off. He says news reports are bad for team morale. Has he ever heard of newspapers or the internet?
Well, not only that, but you know what else is bad for team morale? Losing every week. That's bad for team morale.
Terrible.
I mean, if you got a problem, Mitchell, just turn all the TVs to, like, Ancient Aliens or something. Start following the impeachment, the Great
Plenty
British,
of options.
The Great British Bake Off, anything.
Wonderful. Yeah. In Australia, the men's national soccer team is called the Socceroos. The women's national team is the Matildas. Don't ask me why. But in one way, these two groups are now the same. And what would that be?
They get paid the same.
Woo!
But unfortunately, they're still called the Matildas, which comes, of course, from the famous song, Waltzing Matilda.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So where do Socceroos come from?
Who knows? Kangaroos, I guess.
Oh, see?
I mean, this is...
You
the,
learned nev- something.
Never let it be said the Australians don't know how to make use of, like, ethno-nationalist cliches. It's like, you know, South Africa is the Springboks. It's named after an antelope. So
right.
Good for the Aussie footy people for going all in on pay equity.
As you say, the highest paid Matilda will soon be paid the same as the highest paid Socceroo. But when it comes to the World Cup, men and women will be paid the same percentage of prize money. So the men will earn a lot more per win than the women do. Whereas in their negotiations, the U.S. women want equal prize money for World Cup wins. Are the U.S. women asking for too much here?
No, because the U.S. women win. I mean, they win the World Cup. They're massively popular. They're incredibly valuable TV product. So they deserve the money that they're asking for.
Yeah.
Because without them, soccer would just be the U.S. men's national team. And that's just not pretty.
Not good. And finally, Charlie, a black cat ran down the field during Monday Night Football. Here's the call from Kevin Harlan.
And the cat is in the CDW red zone. CDW, people who get it now, a policeman, a state trooper has come on the field, and the cat runs into the end zone. That is a touchdown.
But not everyone was so happy with the antics of the black cat, right?
No, DeMarcus Lawrence, a gigantic defensive end for the Cowboys, apparently was terrified. He said, they got bad luck now. It turned on him. He said, man, the game's over. A black cat runs in the damn field in a Monday Night Football game. You might want to call it quits, bro. Y'all's luck is terrible. I'd argue with DeMarcus, and I wouldn't anyway. However, the cat does have his own Twitter page now.
Excellent. Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
If you haven't heard, self-partnering is in. I'm not totally sure what it means, but the internet tells me it has something to do with being committed to taking care of yourself. Well, here's one tip for taking care of yourself. Subscribe to the Only a Game podcast. That way, you'll receive our mix of funny, moving, and surprising stories every week. Major League Soccer hosts its 24th championship game this weekend. MLS has seen teams fold, like the Tampa Bay Mutiny in 2001, and teams move, like the San Jose Earthquakes to Houston in 2005. But this story is about a team that stayed, thanks in large part to one of the biggest grassroots movements ever in American sports. Here's Arlo Moore Bloom.
In 1996, the Columbus Crew was announced as one of Major League Soccer's first franchises. They had already sold 12,000 season tickets.
First of all, I'm from Columbus. I was born here. I was raised here. I live here. I will die here.
Morgan Hughes was 14 years old when he saw his first Crew game in 1996. He's been a super fan ever since.
The Columbus Crew were a natural fit for me. It's my little slice of black and gold heaven. It's my home away from home. Sometimes it feels like my first home.
Morgan is a small business owner. In his spare time, he meets up with his friends to make artwork for the Crew's home games.
I make big pieces of art. Flags, two sticks, giant crowd banners that are as large as 90 feet long by 50 feet wide.
Since 1996, Major League Soccer has grown a lot. By 2013, MLS had more than doubled from 10 original franchises to 21. Much of that growth was thanks to Clark Hunt, the owner of the Crew. A member investor since the beginning, Clark was one of the driving forces behind the creation of MLS in the first place. But on August 31st, 2013, he called a press conference.
Today we are officially announcing that we have sold the team to Anthony Precourt, who is now my pleasure to introduce. Anthony?
Thank you, Clark.
Anthony Precourt is a hedge fund manager from San Francisco. And the biggest question for the fans, would an outsider keep the Crew in Columbus? Precourt saw the question coming.
And trust me, I've had many sleepless nights over the last few months thinking about and dreaming about our future together. And all you need to know is that I'm very committed to Columbus, and I'm here with you.
Within 2 years of that first press conference, a relationship developed between the Columbus Crew and the Austin Aztecs, a lower division pro team based 1,200 miles away in Texas. The crew sent reserves to train in Austin, and the two teams co-hosted a preseason tournament in February of 2015.
There wasn't really, you know, a feeling that there was anything nefarious going on at the time.
That's Chris Bills, a freelance reporter based in Austin.
But now looking back on it, you know, that was a way for the ownership of the Columbus Crew to kind of get on the ground and see what Austin was all about.
A year later, in September of 2016, Austin Mayor Steve Adler was contacted by Major League Soccer, saying that the league was studying Austin's viability as a home for an MLS franchise.
Mayor Adler was surprised at the time because there was not an expansion bid coming from Austin.
If Austin wasn't getting an expansion team, it could only mean one thing. A team would have to move.
At some point, he was told officially that the Columbus Crew was looking to move to Austin.
The move was top secret, but there were signs that Precourt wasn't committed to Columbus. Toilet paper was often missing in stadium bathrooms, and concession stands would often run out of snacks within the first half. And unbeknownst to Crew fans, Precourt had already laid the groundwork for a move when he bought the Crew.
There was a clause within the contract.
That's David Miller, a Crew fan who works for Columbus's city council.
That he wasn't allowed to move the team unless it was to Austin, Texas.
On October 16th, 2017, David, Morgan, and the rest of Crew fandom found out what was going on.
I was sitting on the back porch at my house, and my buddy John texted me and said, I'm hearing bad things. I'm hearing that the Crew is going to move to Austin. And I didn't believe him. And so I tried to start reaching out to my contacts, and the only ones who would respond would say, I can't say anything about it, but stay tuned. And sure enough, I believe it was either 9:50 p.m. or 10:50 p.m. that night, Grant Wall from Sports Illustrated sent that tweet of infamy about Precourt potentially moving the team to Austin. And my world kind of went blank. I was kind of floating through life for that first, 18 hours. It's literally our community. It's why we use that word so much. It's like saying they were going to wipe your neighborhood off of the face of the earth.
The next day, Morgan was walking his dog and talking to the Crew's radio announcer, Chris Duran. They had gotten to know each other from years of Crew involvement. Chris told Morgan, I wish I could do something.
And I realized that, I had assumed that if anything was to be done about this, it was going to be done by somebody who I identified as more important than I. And at that moment, I just decided that I was done being a victim of Anthony Precourt. And if there was going to be a funeral for the Columbus Crew, then I was going to be too tired from lashing out against it to attend it. And that was the moment that Save the Crew was born, in that park, walking my dog.
Morgan drove to Hendock's Pub, where Crew fans had gathered to drown their sorrows.
It was a wake. It was a wake. There's literally a funeral home next door to that bar. So,
but Morgan didn't go to the bar to cry. He went to convince Crew fans to keep fighting.
I sent out a tweet that said, if you think this is over, you're wrong. This is not over. Tell everyone you know. Hashtag Save the Crew.
Some Crew supporters wanted to stage a protest when the team played New York City FC 5 days later. Morgan thought otherwise.
It's an away game. What, are we going to show up at the stadium and burn our Crew jerseys? Like, that's what they'd want us to do. Then they'd have bad guys to point to. So I said, we need a rally.
Today, from the grass to a grassroots campaign, fans rallied at City Hall to save the Crew.
At the next home game on October 31st, Morgan had a special plan for his game day artwork.
So there was a banner that said, respect our roots. And it was kind of our way of telling the world that, you know, Columbus is the foundation upon which this entire league is built in this country. And if you allow them to destroy us, they'll come for you next. The first time that entire stadium lit up and every human in it was chanting Save the Crew was a moment that goes to the grave with me that I will never fully separate from.
Within weeks, 58 members of Save the Crew had organized into 12 teams who took charge of government and business relations, design and brand management, financing, event marketing, merchandising, and more.
There were so many people that were interested in doing something.
That's David Miller again, who became the communications director for Save the Crew.
So many people who just kind of wanted to be involved.
For the next year, Morgan, David, and several other leaders worked nonstop to save the crew.
People from the news saying, what time are you going to be home? Can we get 5 minutes with you on camera? It was doing interviews with the BBC World Service, and I was planning a wedding during this. It was, I was buying a house during this. But every moment of every day, no matter how exhausting, there was only one end goal. We are going to save the crew.
Save the Crew continued to gain momentum. Other MLS supporter groups wore yellow and black Save the Crew armbands at games around the country.
We brought together an international community of concerned soccer fans.
You know, Chelsea FC.
That's one of the most popular soccer teams in the world.
Ran an article in their game day program for a match talking about our plight. We had news articles across the globe that were talking about this because we were good at spreading our message, talking on social media, being positive, and really kind of set an example for communities at risk.
By spring of 2018, Precourt was closing in on a stadium deal in Austin. But Save the Crew got the attention of Ohio's attorney general. And because the Crew's stadium had been built with tax dollars, he could step in.
Attorney General Mike DeWine filed a lawsuit against Precourt Sports Ventures and Major League Soccer. Now, the lawsuit is over your tax dollars.
Since DeWine used Ohio's Art Modell Law, passed in 1996, after the Cleveland Browns owner moved his team to Baltimore in secret. DeWine hoped that the lawsuit would help buy city officials time to negotiate with someone else to buy the team. And in October of 2018, a group of civic and business leaders, including team Dr. Pete Edwards and Browns owner Jimmy Haslam, emerged as buyers of the Crew franchise. The Crew was saved.
I found out on October 10th, 2018 at 7:57 p.m.
It was almost exactly a year after Morgan sat on his back porch, feeling like he wasn't a part of this world.
There was about a 30-second period there where I don't think I remembered to breathe. I went inside and I sat on my living room floor and I just lost it emotionally. I choked on my own tears. I coughed and then I started the cycle all over again. Laughing, crying, choking.
The world found out 2 days later on Friday, October 12th. Fans descended on bars across Columbus in the middle of the day, including Hendock's Pub, where Save the Crew was born.
In the grand scheme of things, you know, a soccer team is not the most important thing in the world, but the fact that we were able to save our soccer team, our community, demonstrates that anything is possible and anything can be done as long as you have people who are willing to put in the time, effort, and have a little bit of savvy in them to get the job done.
And earlier this fall, Columbus named October 12th as the first Saved the Crew Day.
I would say that we are the most successful grassroots movement in the history of American sports.
That story came from Arlo Moore Bloom. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Jonathan Chang. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.